All right, we're going to get rolling here, so must be a RILA meeting. The room is cleared out. So let's call the meeting to order. I'd like to welcome the meeting of the Research and Innovation Legal and Legislative Affairs Committee. The meeting is called to order. Mrs. Wright. So it's not Ms., it's Mrs.
Yes.
Okay. Make sure I didn't screw it up here. Would you please call the roll?
Vice Committee Chair Rita Athus.
Present.
Trustee Dennis Barsima.
Here.
Trustee John Butler.
Here.
Trustee Veronica Herrero. Trustee Aiden O'Brien.
Here.
Trustee Leland Strum.
Here.
Committee Chair Eric Wazowitz.
Here.
Board Chair Montel Gales.
Here.
Thank you.
Mr. Perry, would you please confirm that appropriate notice of this meeting has been provided and that we have a quorum present?
Morning, Mr. Chair. You have a quorum present and appropriate notice has been provided pursuant to the Illinois Open Meetings Act.
May I have a motion to approve the agenda as proposed?
So moved, Barsima.
Second, Gales.
Is there any discussion? And we'll call the question. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Now, may I have a motion to approve the minutes of our previous meeting?
So moved.
Second, Barsima.
We have a motion.
You've broken me, Eric.
I have that effect on people. We have a motion and we have a second. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, we'll call the question. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. I want to welcome any University Advisory Committee representatives present today. Do you have any comments?
We are excited to welcome our new VP for RIPS. It's great to see you in this formal setting, and we look forward to working with you over the upcoming term of your service. Thank you.
Thank you, man. Excited to be here.
All right. I'd like it to be shown on the record that Trustee Herrero has joined the meeting. So welcome, Veronica.
Thank you.
Committee chair. So I'm the new committee chair, so I get to have a couple comments here. First of all, I'm excited to be the RILA chair, and I want to welcome again Richard. So Richard Mokarski. So we have a similar Polish name, so we should get all this stuff correct, I would think. It's one of the best kept secrets, I think, that we have an amazing research program at NIU, and we are expecting a continuation of great things. Sorry to put the pressure on you. I say continuation because I first met President Freeman when she was the new vice president of research here at Northern Illinois University. And we're glad that you came in and glad that you stayed.
Thank
so.
You. Happy to be here.
By the way, and one other thing, too, when we get to FACFO, our FACFO committee chair is here. I thought I'd use the bully pulpit to say that if we want to save some money, can we ask the Secretary of State to just add the blue book to the website? I'm guessing that a personalized leather-bound book has got to cost an enormous amount of money these days. So, Mr. FACFO chair, maybe you can get to work on that at some point.
We did not pay for that.
Somebody
Dr. Streb, is this statutory?
I don't know, but I've actually raised this with the state before to no avail. So, but I will now say that we've officially had our board asked to not have these blue books spent, not just to you, but to all sorts of other people on campus as well.
Yeah.
As the person, and Katie, I think, can confirm this, the two people that probably oversee state relations the most or look at state relations the most, we never use them. So.
Okay. Well, maybe we can bring that up again then. When we get to that point. Anyway.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, will we be getting a phone book as well?
If we do, hopefully it's not leather bound with your name on it. So, extra cost. So, we recognize members of the public who have complied with state law and Board of Trustees bylaws by registering their written request to address the board with our parliamentarian, Mr. Perry. Have you received any timely requests to address this meeting?
Mr. Chair, no public comment this morning.
Okay. At this point, I'd like to ask Vice President for Research and Innovation Partnerships, Richard Mokarski, for news items and comments.
Thank you, Chair Wasowitz. Get that right?
Correct.
Oh, great.
Well done. My father would say Von Savage, but that's a whole other story.
I'm really excited to be here. I thought I'd share some brief comments, being that this is my first RILA committee, to introduce myself to the NIU community. Hopefully, I feel like I've met everybody who's in this room, but I'm looking forward to meeting more of the committee. And start just with a short biography. I've been doing research administration for 20 years, and I've been at a number of different institutions, from massive institutions where faculty and students can often get lost, like the, no offense to North Carolina Chapel Hill, but that's kind of what it is, to institutions like NIU. And the reason I'm at NIU is because I believe we thread the needle between sophisticated research and artistry while still providing access to students, access for experiential learning to world-class experts. And that's something that I think we need to announce to the world every chance we get. This is not like our friends in Evanston, right? If you're an undergraduate, graduate student, you're going to get access to your faculty. And your faculty are doing work that is world-changing. And that is something that can't be said across the board at some of those larger institutions. And at smaller institutions, they're not doing the same kind of world-class research we're doing. So I think it's really important that we announce that and we be a brand driver for the institution. My philosophy is always that the Academy is a knowledge commons. We are the sort of last bastion of creating knowledge without a profit motive. And part, we talk about knowledge and giving it to our students in the classrooms, but we're also having an impact in society. And I believe RIPS is here to serve that mission. We're here, we have a, if we're a company, if RIPS is a company, our product is faculty and student success. That means our customers are faculty for the most part. And so I'm gonna try and embody that and have our whole team embody that so that we are giving faculty the tools to amplify their impact. Our faculty would not be here if they weren't passionate about what they did and if they weren't good at what they did. They didn't get PhDs, MFAs, JDs because it was fun and then not go into industry where, frankly, the fiduciary impact on them would be higher. They're here because they care about it. And so my goal is to connect them to their passion. So to build that, to scaffold that, my team has been working, my leadership team, on a strategic plan. We had a day and a half retreat where we started to put a strategic plan together by defining our vision, our values, and our mission. I wanna share just the draft of that here quickly. So our values, we decided on, we are, our RIPS is nurturing, resourceful, ethical, we're a partner, we're accessible, we're change agents, and we're joyous. Again, we should be the fun group. We're here to connect people to their passion. Our vision is to grow research and creative enterprise to empower world-transforming discovery, paradigm-shifting expression, and life-changing student opportunities. And our mission is to create an ecosystem for thriving and growing research and creative enterprise. So this year, we're going to focus on five goals in that mission, vision, values, and we'll scale our tactics to those goals, and we'll have KPIs on those. It's way too long to share this, but I can share the goals. So our goals are to grow research and artistry and innovation. And when I say grow, I don't just mean financially, I mean an impact. How do we give faculty the tools to have the impact on their students, but also to have the impact on the world? Develop and expand partnerships, both internally, get folks collaborating, and externally. Nurture an entrepreneurial mindset, improve our own operational effectiveness, and to increase our brand awareness. And that, again, is both internal and external. We need faculty to know who we are and what we're there for, but we also need the world to know what research and artistry is happening on this campus. So those are my brief comments. I do have one sort of more technocratic comment that should be noted. So Dara Little, our AVP, will be giving the report later, and she'll talk about this a little bit in terms of how awards are counted. We have made a change in the way we count awards. We're amortizing our awards as opposed to looking at if $10 million comes in on one award for a five-year award, we're counting it as the budget is going to be expended instead of, well, we got $10 million this year. That should level the way our awards go up and down, but it should also be more accurate. If you lose a faculty member who has a $10 million grant in year two and you reported $10 million, you really only got to spend four. So I think that's important. So with that, I'll turn it back over.
Okay. So we now move to the university reports. Agenda item 7A, state legislative report. Ms. Katie Davidson. Katie, are you here?
I am. Good morning.
There you go. Hey, Katie. How's it going?
Good. I'm getting a little echo, but I think it's good now.
Okay.
Can everyone hear me okay?
Yes.
Wonderful.
You're on.
All right. Thank you for allowing me to provide a supplemental report to the one you have in your packet that provided an end-of-session summary. Since submitting the board report, legislation for the funding formula has been drafted, though it's not been formally written, so you won't find it on the NEOBA website. But for future reference, that bill number is Senate Bill 3965. We'll be hearing a lot about that this coming veto and spring sessions. On July 30th, the chairs of the commission and the bill's sponsors, Senator Kimberly Lightford and Representative Carol Ammons, held a press conference at the Illinois Innovation Network in downtown downtown Chicago. President Freeman spoke at the event, expressing our appreciation for the legislature's efforts to create a funding model that is adequate, equitable, and stable. She emphasized the importance of acknowledging the historic disinvestment in higher education and its impact on institutions like NIU. Following the press conference, President Freeman and I participated in a facilitated roundtable discussion at the event. While the proposed legislation closely aligns with the recommendations submitted by the Commission on Equitable Public University Funding, we're currently reviewing the language to assess the formula model and just dig into that legislation. Discussions on the proposed formula are ongoing, though. So during this traditionally slower season, I'm taking the opportunity to engage closely with campus leadership. Our focus is on developing robust messaging materials that highlight our impact, as well as identify areas that we can seek legislative relief and modernize outdated or unrealistic practices. I want to just take this opportunity to recognize President Freeman's leadership in pushing us to be student-centered, equity-focused, and data-informed. She challenges us to think beyond traditional practices to better serve our students, and it shows. This has led to the development and implementation of policies and practices that not only enhance the educational experience, but also promote inclusivity and fairness across all aspects of university life. And NIU has consistently led by example, setting the standard for how universities can create inclusive environments while delivering high-quality education. And this is evident in the fact that nearly every legislative session that I've participated in since returning to NIU has resulted in laws mandating that other public universities in Illinois adopt practices and policies that we've already established. And it just happened again last spring. So, as we move forward, our focus will remain on advocating for sustainable funding and continuing to set the standard for excellence in higher education and just promoting the heck out of that in Springfield. So I will yield for any questions.
Anyone have questions for Katie? Katie, are you in Springfield or Chicago right now?
I'm in Springfield.
Okay.
I'm in my own.
Staying away from Chicago. So
yes, the DNC has definitely drawn a lot of people out of Springfield, so it's really quiet here.
Okay, good. And then also, I'm not sure if you saw before, but these books, you know, if we want to save some money.
I'm developing a comprehensive list of all the ways in which we could potentially save money. So that's when I mentioned being on campus or working with campus leadership, that's exactly what we're going to be doing. We're creating an inventory of kind of all those things that, you know, collectively add up to administrative burden, excess cost, you know, all of those things. So,
okay, thank you. Anything else for Katie? If not, we'll say thank you, Katie, and we'll move on with the meeting here. Agenda item 7B, the Federal Relations Report, Ms. Julia Rowe. There you are. All right. Hey, Julia. I'm guessing you're in D.C.
I am in D.C.
Okay.
So I want to start with an advocacy update. On June 11th, President Freeman was in Washington, D.C., and met with members of the Illinois delegation to discuss NIA's FY25 appropriations requests and our legislative priorities. On July 18th, Congresswoman Underwood and 22 of her district in Washington, D.C. based staff were on campus to tour federal youth-funded programs and student service resource centers. The visit was a great success and brought together many campus stakeholders. For an appropriations update, the House has passed all 12 of the appropriation bills out of committee, and 5 have passed on the House floor. While the Senate is still working through their process, the federal government's budget ends on September 31st, so Congress has a lot of work to do in return from the office recess in a couple of weeks. Of note, in the House Labor Age of Just bill includes an 11% across-the-board cut from FY24. This cut includes 50% cut to SEOG and federal work study, and the bill would again flat-fund the maximum Pell Grant and includes further cuts to programs of key importance to NIU. Also, in the House Commerce Justice Science bill, there's a 2% cut to the National Science Foundation. On the legislative side, the House has advanced their NDAA, or the National Defense Authorization Act. The amendments of concern for NIU, including the Deterrent Act and the Bipartisan Workforce Pell Act, were not made in order during floor consideration. The Senate Armed Services Committee is working on their version of the NDAA, which includes some revisions of concern related to research awards, limitations on international collaborations, and prohibition on institutions who are violating Title IV of the Civil Rights Act from receiving DOD funding. The Higher Education Advocacy Community is working on the NDAA amendments and kind of where that will shake out when Congress returns in September. Moving to the administration, the Department of Education has said they will have a fully working class reform by December 1st of this year. That is 2 months later than the typical October 1st deadline. They are said to be making improvements to the form and will keep the 25-26 academic year form consistent with the 24-25 academic year form to streamline the process, but we will see what those improvements are when we begin rolling out test forms in October. On June 18th, the White House announced several changes to the DACA program, including allowing non-citizen spouses and children to apply for permanent resident status and easing the visa process for U.S. college graduates. Looking to the courts, there have been multiple injunctions to the Biden administration's Title IX rule delaying implementation in many states. However, Illinois was not involved in those cases, and the rule went into effect on August 1st. And a quick election update. As you all know, in July, the RNC hosted the convention in Milwaukee to officially nominate former President Trump as their nominee. Also in July, President Biden stepped aside and will no longer run for a second term. And this week, the DNC hosted a convention in Chicago and will officially nominate Vice President Harris as their nominee this evening. The presidential race remains quite tight. Thank you, and happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Julia? Trustee Barsima?
Thank you. Thank you for your update. Very thorough. One of the things, and if you mentioned it or you covered it and I missed it, I apologize, but in your write-up under FAFSA, you mentioned here that they're going to continue it for the coming year. Is that using the form that just came out this year? They're going to continue it into next year? Or are they going back to the old form because the new form had such issues? I'm assuming they're forging ahead with the new form.
Yeah, so they are staying consistent with the form that came out last year. So it's the academic 24-25. And the form that we saw, they have worked through the issues of that form. To my understanding, we have not seen it yet. So it is the same form. They did that process if the department were to make any changes to the form that it had released last year, they would have to go through a notice and comment period, which would have further caused delays. So they're going ahead with the form we all saw last year, but they've made improvements to the back end as well hopefully that the process really worked out the kinks of that form. We have not seen it. We will see test batches for students and institutions in October.
Okay.
And we'll have more information of what the changes or improvements have been.
Where are we right now? I know we were kind of tracking, you know, we're 25% behind, then 20% behind, then 15% behind where we were the previous year. Did we ever catch up?
We made progress, but I'm going to let Vice President Jensen give the details. And Saul, maybe while you're up there, you can talk about our optimism about the next year's implementation and the, you know, the difference between the functionality of the changes and the spirit behind the changes, because I think that's good to remind the board of all those things.
Absolutely. So actually, I get a regular report on where we're at with our incoming students and returning students. As a total, we're still about 10% down from last year at this same time. So a considerable number of that, about 11%, is on new first-year students. And the other larger number is our returning students. So that number was about 9% down. The only number that looks a little bit more positive is in our transfer students. But altogether, we're still about 10,000 or 10% down. It equates to over 2,000 fewer FAFSAs that have been completed to NIU than last year at the same time. I will say that we do continue to work with students. We're continuing to putting on workshops. We held a workshop in collaboration with ISAC just about a week and a half ago that was literally open to the entire community. ISAC did receive some federal funding to assist with doing additional reach out and working. It's not ideal, but you know, we certainly can continue to have students complete the FAFSA after they have enrolled. But of course, we would love for students to have their full financial aid understood prior to the start of classes. But it's actually normal for us to have some students who don't have a full financial aid package yet. They're still going through various verification and so forth. So it's not unheard of. To what Julia was saying, I will agree. I think that there's still a lot of unknown on how next year is actually going to impact. You know, you could debate, you could argue there's pros and cons to whether there were more significant changes that could have been implemented, but I completely understand the acknowledgement that doing so would have prolonged, and we would have probably been in the same situation as we were this year. I think that, you know, one of the significant concerns that we still have is many people, and especially from the Department of Education, communicate more publicly that things are fixed. And to be completely honest, we are still continuing to fix the fixes. What ultimately has happened is that the department needed to move on, and they have basically said, institutionally, some of these things are left up to you. And so there are still many significant fixes that have to happen institutionally that we are still working on. So when you even hear about, even though they're not making any significant changes for next year, essentially what they're saying is we have a lot of major fixes that still have to get completed. But absolutely, still moving forward with the newer FAFSA, with the ability to bring in tax information from the IRS. I mean, all of those things theoretically are the right move and are in the benefit ultimately of students. It's just there's still a lot of errors and miscalculations as part of their formulas.
So, you know, the $64 question is the goal of the rewrite for FAFSA was, and I remember, I forget if it was a representative or in the Senate, but they walked in with the old the old application in their hand and they were dragging it. It was so long, they dragged it on the floor. So it was to minimize or to reduce the complexity of the application. Did they accomplish that?
For some populations, yes. And probably even, I'd say, the majority once they got through the fixes. The problem is that for many populations, especially those from underserved communities, it actually made it a little bit more difficult this year. And so that's where, well, that's NIU. And that's where we've seen some significant challenges over the past months, is trying to get the Department of Education to make fixes there. And again, in some cases, they have just essentially said, this is up to you institutionally to figure this out. And we've got good communications between financial aid directors across the state public institutions. There's not a necessarily 100% collective on how everyone's treating every case by case, but there is some pretty good collaboration happening there. But absolutely, when you talk to some individuals who have gone through the process, it has been more simplified. It's shorter, it's quicker. Tax information comes directly from the IRS, and so people aren't having to calculate their own taxes into the form anymore. But there's still too high of a population of students. And when we say, okay, well, maybe only 25% were impacted, well, that's 25% are millions of students. And so collectively, that's the concern. And those millions of students are the ones that already were coming from communities or populations where going to college may or may not have been something that was on their mind. And so there's obviously concern, not just at NIU, but across the country, about what is the ultimate impact on college-going rates for many of these students.
Has there been any discussion of Congress convening a committee to be able to testify in front of Congress, folks like yourself, to say, here's what really happened, or here's how it's impacting us? Because it seems like this was a not so well run program that is impacting millions of citizens.
I would turn that over to my colleague Julie and see if she has any thoughts on that.
Yeah, the House Education Committee has had hearings on this. I believe the Redfield FAFSA director, as well as Secretary Cardozo, when he was testifying on the education budget, the Education Workforce Committee has not held numerous hearings on this, however. So while this is of interest and of concern to the chairwoman and the ranking member, this has not been at the forefront of the committee's hearings.
If I could add one thing to what Saul and Julia said, the other people who were adversely impacted by this and rose like heroes to the occasion are our financial aid staff. And the financial aid staff here and at every university, they, in the face of bad information, misinformation, lack of support, have kept the students at the forefront, have worked incredible hours, have hand-processed things that used to be able to be batch-processed, and we wouldn't be where we were without their commitment, and I think they deserve to be recognized.
Well, and I will make mention, I was working with one student who was having an issue with awards and grants and so forth, and Katie Saalfeld, am I pronouncing the last name correctly, was amazing. So I don't think Katie's in the room today, right, but she was amazing to work with. So, yeah, great team.
Trustee Butler.
So can you help us understand, are there other elements of this process that are worth talking about with respect to how new students are encouraged at the high school level to produce these forms, or I mean to to file these applications. Are there, I mean, is where does the obligation to assist them land? Does it land more on us? Does it land more on the high schools? And it, are there any breakdowns in that process?
I have to be careful what I say.
That's okay. Bring it on.
Shoot. I would say, Trustee Butler, I would say I attended a summit this week or this summer that was led by a partner of ours. That included maybe 30 other institutions. And we had a conversation, and the question that was posed was something similar to what we discussed right after COVID, which was, what have you learned or what have you implemented over this past year with the FAFSA debacle that you plan to continue to do moving forward into the future? I will say this in response to your question, is that NIU and probably most institutions had not been very involved in the actual FAFSA completion process until this year, where we've really tried to be more forthright. We've really mostly left it up to the high schools, and I'm trying to get guidance from their counselors, and they, many high schools do FAFSA workshops and FAFSA nights, and we've attended those and presented when invited. But I think one of the key takeaways for me is that we have to be a much more visible and collaborative partner with ISAC. Not that we haven't been already, but we have to be more proactive, is probably the better word, in terms of making sure that we are assisting in that FAFSA completion workshop, especially at the communities where the FAFSA filing rate has been lower traditionally. I think to the other question, we're challenged a little bit recently in the state, mm-hmm. because there has been a push to make the law around filing the FAFSA as a graduation requirement, that there's been a significant push to waive that across the state and to make the waiver process much easier, which may have been, again, there's pros and cons. It may have been a useful scenario this year as things were really, really late, and there were even many students who had not completed the FAFSA at the time of high school getting out for the summer. And so literally there was no one at the high schools there left to help the students. But even as we start a new year and a new process with the intention that now you have months of lead time and months of opportunity to work with students at the high school level, we continue to see a significant push for these waivers, for schools to opt out and to make this process very, very easy and simple. And to be honest, it goes against why the law was there in the first place. This is, I'm just opining as myself. But that's where I think NIU and our student service team is going to be much more proactive this year moving forward. We're going to be reaching out to ISAC. We even just started earlier this week having a conversation about utilizing ISAC on a regular basis and even potentially having some open space here on our campus where on a weekly basis, one of the individuals from ISAC can be on our campus and we can regularly be offering financial aid workshops to our current students, to anyone in the community. And so I think that's one of our key takeaways moving forward.
Can I add someone just, I think it's just really important for us to look at another example of when things go awry, it's the communities that are already under-resourced and underserved who are disproportionately impacted. And when you look at FAFSA completion rates and where they have fallen the most, fallen off the most in the state, it's not a surprise. It's in the city of Chicago, and it's in those zip codes in Chicago where they have the tier one schools and the communities that are the least resourced. Yeah. Well, 8 of our 10 top feeder zip codes are from Chicago. I don't think it's a secret to anyone who reads the newspaper, who turns on the news, that Chicago Public Schools is struggling to meet their financial challenges. And making waivers easier so that a law that was put in place to make sure that every child had the opportunity to see their chance to go to college, to see that as part of their future, gets watered down where it's needed the most. It's shameful. We shouldn't be doing that. And I think it's right that NIU steps in, but I also want to point out that us stepping in to do the job that should have been done by the state, by the ISBE mandate, by the schools, costs money. There are other universities in the state where students aren't struggling to see themselves in college. Students who are talented, students who should be there, they just don't have resources. They don't have families who know how to fill out these forms. And so when we step in to do that job, we are doing morally the right thing, but it comes at a cost that's not a cost to an institution that serves a more affluent, privileged, different population than we serve. And so these things are all linked. When Katie talks about equitable, stable, and adequate funding, and Julia talks about the federal programs that are being looked at for cuts, and we say we don't want to see this happen to our students because we know that we are the future of America, those things are all linked.
Trustee Herrera,
thank you. Yes. Probably just like reinforcing some of what you've already said, Dr. Freeman, and as well as you, Saul. One is, you know, I'm curious to look into the reasons for why the waivers would continue to encourage waivers. So I am really curious to understand why that would be the case this year, because I think we would all understand why it had to be done this past year, given the debacle with the FAFSA. But what I do want to acknowledge is that what can easily happen between the K-12 system and the, you know, higher ed system is it's your responsibility. And who ends up losing is our students, and they get stuck in the middle, right? And if, you know, the school systems don't have the resources to support their students in completing the FAFSA, then, you know, the bucket's passed over to higher ed. But what I appreciate from what I heard you say is that we're not doing that. We're not going to point fingers, right? And we are going to rely on ISAC as well to be a greater partner in being that connector between the two systems. And I just want to make sure that we all recognize that. That is so very important for systems change and for creating a student-centered higher ed ecosystem, period, is that we don't point fingers and we don't, you know, leave the responsibility for, you know, to any institution, any single institution or system, especially when it comes to issues of students who are graduating, right? And then they get stuck in the middle. Mm-hmm. So I just want to thank you all for stepping in at a time like this. And I know you all will continue to, because I know that's in the spirit of, you know, of, I know your vision for equity, right? And as well as yours, Saul. And it's just really important that we continue to work collaboratively and work with ISAC to make sure that they are supporting that glue, right, that needs to be there to make the system work. So just thank you.
Lee?
I'm just curious, Dr. Freeman, the cost associated with this, I mean, is it possible to quantify those costs? I mean, obviously it's staff time, it's involved in that. Are there other areas of this that play into the cost to this university of this?
You know, Lee, it's staff time is a large part of it. Just infrastructure, so that students can see where to get the support, so that we can meet students where they are, both literally and figuratively. If you look at the equity-based funding model that the State of Illinois is proposing, it acknowledges that there are basically three major things that affect what needs, what a school, what goes into what makes funding adequate for a school, which is another way of looking at what a school needs to achieve the mission. And so it's the mission, it's the size, but it's a number of students served, but it's also the nature of those students served. And so even if you look at the equity formula, they've looked at successful operations in CUNY. They've looked at our own partnership with Rockford Promise, and they've done some back of the envelope calculations to say this is the added cost. So I would say look at the Funding Commission report, and you can see one approach to documenting that cost. Could we do it very specifically for NIU? We probably could, but then the staff that are needed to do all the other things that we need to do to be student-centered would be making those calculations, and I'm not sure we actually have the bandwidth. Maybe as we get towards appropriations, we'll lean into that a little further, because I do think that's an important thing to keep raising.
Mm-hmm. And if I can just say that I think the question is how much is it costing us, but how much also would it costs us to not do it, right? I think that the cost of not supporting the students and not providing the services is probably greater than what it's costing us to do it. Though I agree that we, you know, for budgeting and financial reasons and funding reasons, we should do that. But, you know, I think there's a cost to not supporting.
I think our state recognizes that. I think that is part of the funding formula that we all can embrace. Mm-hmm.
Trustee Butler.
Well, I think there's also the opportunity losses related to the prospective new students that might come into the institution that won't because they're not clear about the affordability of the opportunity, and I guess it's somewhat off item, more of a state relations question. I sense a little sensitivity around the issue, so I won't, you know, try to make it clear what concerns me, but I do hope that we are engaging in our state relations practice with the proper folks at whichever agency, I've heard a few now, to make sure that we are advocating in the best interest of that law that we're talking about and the enforcement of the law. You know, that's just my thoughts.
Any other thoughts, comments? Saul, I did have one final question here. So how, as you look around the state and our peers, the other state institutions, how are they dealing with this?
Everyone's dealing with it to some regard, to some severity. It's been actually a couple of months since I've had a pretty in-depth conversation with my peers, but especially up until about May or June, which there was still a lot in flux at that point, there were significant concerns. And we saw different universities take some different tacks, and to the president's point, the universities that have significant resources available to them did things very differently than the rest of the institutions. And so now in terms of everyone's still dealing with fixes, everyone's still dealing with how to, because the fixes are not just errors and miscalculations from the Department of Education, but you know everything then runs through, for us it's PeopleSoft, other schools it's Banner. Mm-hmm. These processes had to be created from scratch, and of course when those get rolled out to campuses, those have bugs and fixes and errors. And so we end up becoming our own programmers and trying to, you know, create those processes. Everyone dealt with that along the same regard, but different institutions based on resources, based on where they stood at the time, were able to do some things differently.
Okay. All right. So, but we don't know how we rate right now with everybody else.
In terms of like FAFSA completions?
Yes. Yes.
I don't, but I can tell you that we continue to look at how NIU compares to the state overall. And again, I had mentioned before, we're about 10%. The state overall is about 10%. So
okay.
If you look at all FAFSA filers, that's community colleges, that's mm-hmm. four-year publics, four-year privates. We sit right on average with the
okay.
state.
All right. All right, thank you. Obviously a very important subject for us, that's for sure. Let's move on to agenda item 7C, sponsored program administrative quarterly report. Dara?
Your voice carries better than mine. All right. So it's good to be here this morning, and thank you, Chair Wasiewicz, for the opportunity, again, to present the full fiscal year 2024 sponsored funding report. Before I get into the information, I want to be sure to acknowledge our faculty and staff, who again have done an outstanding job of competing for and winning external funding. This report and the work in sponsored programs would not be possible without the extraordinary efforts of our faculty. I also want to acknowledge the hard work and commitment of my team in supporting sponsored funding and supporting faculty and doing everything that they can to get the proposals in on time and to manage the awards and everything that goes along with that. As I always say every year, really, I'm just the messenger here of the information. The appreciation and the work goes to the faculty and to my team. Next slide, please. So my report this morning will cover a few funding trends, and then I will highlight some notable programs and initiatives that external funding is supporting here at NIU. And then I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about the evolving grants management landscape and how we are responding to it in sponsored programs, because I think that's very important in terms of how we think about how we structure ourselves to continue with the growth that you're going to see here in a moment. Just as a point of clarification, if you've read the written report, there's a lot of numbers flying around, so I do apologize for that. The written report, just given the timing of that, that has 5 years of data. But the report here that I'm giving this morning is a look back to the past 10 years. We've just had a little bit more time to prepare that information. So just to keep those differences in mind. I do think that the 10-year look back is particularly helpful in terms of having a truer representation of how we are doing in sponsored funding compared to a pre-COVID environment. And given just other factors that have been at play influencing external funding and grants during that time. Certainly in the last 10 years, which I'm going to talk about a little bit more later, the funding ecosystem and grants management has changed significantly in the last 10 years, both in opportunities and in challenges. Many of those not unique to NIU. It's something that we're seeing across the board. I look forward to partnering with VP Makarski to continue to work on how to respond to our growing portfolio and for his insights and really fresh perspective in how we do research administration here at NIU. Next slide, please. All right. So for this slide, this is a look at the 10-year funding trends. Just following up on Richard's remarks previously about how we're counting our awards, essentially what our data has traditionally been based off of is that we count the funding when it has been authorized and brought into sponsored programs. So that's what this trend data is based on, and so there may be some changes in the future, but that's kind of the basis now for what you're seeing. You can see there's two line graphs there. The blue line represents the total sponsored funding since fiscal year 2014. That includes the spike in COVID relief funds that were received and managed through sponsored programs. As we all know, that money was very real. It impacted our work. It impacted the work across many institutional units, and it will for years to come. But again, it's not probably a true representation of sponsored funding. So I'm looking more at the red line, which you can also see that there has been considerable growth in the last 10 years. Indeed, since 2014, there has been a 46% increase in sponsored funding. Our faculty are clearly competitive in securing external awards. And all of that despite a highly competitive environment and with limited developmental resources. Next slide, please. So this chart is showing the growth in funding across the different types of programs. In the last 10 years, research funding has doubled. It's up an astounding 102%. Instruction programs is up 41%. And other sponsored activities, which includes a lot of the public service type programs, demonstration programs, engagement programs that the university conducts, that is up 32%. Again, because of the way that we've been accounting awards, that's why you see some variability, particularly with other sponsored activities. I did take a look at the data, and back in 2014, that's a perfect example of what Richard was mentioning. We counted a very large $7 million award in that year. So I think if you made adjustments, I would probably contend that other sponsored activities has up more than 32% in the last 10 years. Next slide, please. So on this slide, you can see the increase by the original source of funding. Again, consistent with our portfolio, federal and state funding accounts for most of the dollars that are coming through sponsored programs. Since 2014, actual state dollars to NIU in the form of grants and contracts has increased 66%. And you can see there that there's been a pretty good size uptick in fiscal years 23 and again here in fiscal year 24. Next slide, please. This slide is a breakout of the funding across college and divisions for this fiscal year. 10-year trend data is available if anybody is interested. I do have that. I didn't include it just because the composition has generally been unchanged over those 10 years, with traditionally liberal arts and sciences holding most of the federal STEM and the research funding, and with outreach, engagement, and regional development holding most of the public service, that other sponsored activity type programming, which is primarily funded by the state of Illinois. Next slide, please. So this is my favorite part of the report that I get to give every year, and just to spend a few minutes talking about the wide array of programs and initiatives that external funding is supporting here at the university. Our annual report will be coming out very soon, and so you'll have an opportunity to read about all of the projects that were funded and that faculty secured support for this fiscal year. But I'm going to start with a project that's near and dear to my heart, and that's the NSF Granted Award that NIU received in partnership with the Illinois Innovation Network. The granted program is part of a federal investment to expanding capacity at emerging research institutions like Northern to enable schools like ours to improve research support and service capacity so that our faculty can more fully participate in the federal funding ecosystem. It's particularly dear to me because it's a clear acknowledgement at the national level that research support and research administration are a key part of the infrastructure necessary to support faculty to successfully compete in the federal funding system. And I'm really happy that NIU is ahead of the curve on this. Kelly Dislin, who's here, director of the RIPS Office of Research and Development, led the NIU proposal that is now spearheading work across the Illinois public institutions and other emerging research institutions to find ways to further leverage our network and to share best practices and to strengthen research administration back in our own institutions. And I thank Kelly and your colleagues at the University of Illinois Chicago, at the IIN, and at Southern for spearheading that work and that grant proposal. I have to imagine that writing an NSF grant proposal while standing up in office was probably no easy feat in the last couple of years. We also obviously have very highly productive faculty who are pushing the boundaries of knowledge, sparking creativity, and winning awards that provide our students with immersive learning opportunities. Our faculty continue to be strong competitors of federally funded research with robust programs from the Department of Energy. This year, the Department of Energy provided $5 million of our total research funding. Our early career faculty continue to excel at securing career development awards. This year, faculty in liberal arts and sciences and in engineering and engineering technology secured prestigious NSF career awards. In the College of Education, faculty secured NIH funding through the SHRE program aimed at enhancing medical research at institutions without large NIH portfolios that serve students from underrepresented groups in biomedical research. And our partnership with the local U.S. Geological Survey is expanding the agency's presence on campus to foster joint education and research programs. And finally, as noted in our state funding trends, the state of Illinois continues to be a major funder of our outreach and service missions that support programs that benefit the region and the state. Next slide, please. So this is where I'll pivot quickly and just spend a few minutes talking about the changing grants management landscape, again, that really has changed in the last 10 years. In previous reports to the board, I have mentioned our modernization efforts to help SPA keep pace with our growing portfolio while providing the highest level of support possible to our faculty. I want to assure you that we are continuing with that work to both provide high-level support and protect the institution. I also want to assure you that the SPA team is committed to supporting external funding, and I will tell you that their true joy really is working directly with faculty, and they are doing a remarkable job of keeping up under the circumstances. But I will say we haven't been able to shake this nagging feeling for a few years that the work just seems really hard. And we couldn't figure out if this was just in our heads or if there was something going on. And what I found is that there is a report by the Council on Governmental Relations, which is an advocacy group comprised of research institutions across the country. What they have found is that there's been a 172% increase in the number of regulations and policies adopted or changed that in some way touch on federal funding in just the last 2 years. Or last 10 years. So while we've been experiencing significant growth in external funding and significant growth in federal funding, so too has the regulatory environment governing those awards. And those regulations extend far beyond sponsored programs. They directly impact our faculty. They cut into many university units, including my colleagues in RIPS, like in the Office of Research Compliance. One example, is research security. That is a new area that we are working very hard to wrap our arms around. So as we navigate that current landscape, I think there's a number of things that we always have to keep at the forefront. The first, federal regulations, executive orders, I don't think those are going to let up anytime soon. So we have to be able to adapt. As a state institution, with the increase in external funding that we've been receiving from the state, and given that 10 years ago, the Grants Accountability and Transparency Act was passed, that has fundamentally changed how the state does grants management. So we have to adapt to that. Adjusting university policies to align with the changing higher ed landscape, that can impact grants management. And most importantly, to make sure that we have and provide an opportunity for faculty and staff to have input into how we respond and structure ourselves in this new environment. I'm optimistic that these disruptors are opportunities for us to further build on the work that we've been doing. Next slide, please. So I will wrap up with a few things that are going on in sponsored programs. First and foremost, our staff are engaging in professional development at all levels and with organizations like the Society of Research Administrators International and the Council on Governmental Relations. They're learning best practices and they're bringing them back for us to implement. And it's helping us to stay abreast of emerging issues. A few examples of this: our post-award recently created a complexity scoring system to more equitably assign grant awards and manage workloads. Pre-award developed a proposal intake process to better control the flow of submissions and also more equitably assign work. I assure you that we are having frequent and robust discussions to better use data analytics to have a more proactive approach to grants management. And yes, we are also talking about using artificial intelligence. There are a lot of opportunities there, and as one of my very smart colleagues has said, we need to find out ways to work smarter, not harder. I'm part of a working group through the Federal Demonstration Partnership to improve research expenditure reporting to improve the higher ed R&D survey. And at the state level, with Kelly heading the Research Administration and Development Subcommittee of the IIN, I'm proud to serve as a co-chair for the new GATA working group to work with the state to look at better ways, improved ways to do grants management. Three of my team members hold the country's formal designation for research administration, and I have another team member sitting for the exam this fall. And finally, in October in Chicago, I will be formally taking the reins as the president of SRAI, which will allow me to further cultivate our network both here within the U.S. and abroad, and to showcase NIU and the important role that emerging research institutions play in the research enterprise. I am particularly excited to let you know that two of our researchers, Dr. Vic Gensini and Dr. Walker Ashley, will be giving the keynote address at that conference in Chicago. So I thank them for taking the time to do that, but that's a great platform for NIU. Next slide, please. Well, I always do this. So in summary, sponsored funding is increasing. We are seeing growth. Research funding has doubled during the last 10 years, and we are continuing to look at ways to respond, including evaluating the right fit for grants management, continuing those modernization efforts, and most importantly, making sure that faculty and staff have an input in how we do this. And that is the last slide. So next slide. With that, I will say thank you and happy to take any questions.
Any questions? Montel?
I was looking at the slide about initiatives, and you had, let me go back here. You list a group here on the screen. I was wondering, are we maxing out our grant opportunities with each one of these partners, grant opportunities, or is there an opportunity to grow an existing grant amount with one of these that I'm looking at on the page here? What's our opportunity to grow these grants?
So I'm an armchair quarterback a little bit, and I may turn it over to the vice president for research on that. With everything that's going on in RIPS, I think there is opportunity for sure, and some of the things that we're putting in place to help identify those opportunities and to pursue those. So Richard, I don't.
Thank you. Yes, I think there's significant opportunity to grow, and part of that is meeting faculty where they are and better understanding what their goals are, and then leaning into, are we asking for the right grant? So we don't have the data on the screen, but I know our acceptance rate here is about double the national average, which means we're asking for the wrong grants. If you're doubling the national average, you're asking for grants that are too small. So instead of asking for the $150,000 SURE grant, we should be asking for the $500,000 R01. We might not get it the first time or the second time, but it's worth the investment to give longer legs and increase that growth opportunity. So that's something we'll be working on in that grow and expand goal this year.
Rita?
I don't have a question as much as a comment. First of all, thank you for your report. It's always so thorough. I have been continually, bless whoever, I have been continually impressed by the amount of research, the amount of funds, the growth we've had. The other thing is I think it is the best kept secret, and somehow we have to get that information out more. So I guess my question is, as the board, what can we be doing to support you more as far as the research going forward? And obviously that's for everyone.
Thank you for that. Yeah, I think that we and RIPS need to provide you all the tools to be able to advocate for us. So mm-hmm. in the coming months, we will be developing communications specifically to highlight the positive aspects of our research and creative activity enterprise that we will be sharing with you, and hopefully provide you that opportunity to share with your networks so they can hear, because I think it is a brand driver for the institution. And helping us to develop partnerships as well is really key. As the federal funding landscape and state funding landscape change, one of the things that's becoming more and more obvious is it's really difficult to go for the sort of institutional changing grants, the NSF engines, the convergence accelerators on your own. You can't do it. And so we don't necessarily need to lead everything, but we need to be partners at the beginning. Oftentimes, our two institutions, emerging institutions of research excellence, are added to these bigger opportunities, but we're added in name only. We're added for workforce development. We're added in sort of an add-on way that doesn't bring value to our campus. So it's a, you know, the Convergent Accelerator is a $160 million award, and we might get $500,000. That's not equitable, right? And so part of that is making sure when those we have those networks from the board, we get in when the development's happening instead of when they're putting the partner list to check a box that they have diversity, equity, inclusion on there, which is often what can happen with us. Not always, we're in front of it on some, but that is where, and so we gotta provide you the tools so you know what we're doing well and can help us build those partnerships.
Thank you, and helping us with the communication would really be appreciated, because I think all of us would like to shout this from the rooftop as far as where we're at with research, so thank you.
Dennis?
Yeah, thank you. As with my fellow trustee, I don't so much have a question as a comment. Thank you for the thoroughness of your report. And I'm going to just make one example. On page 14, you're showing the year-over-year increase or decrease of funding by college or by representative department, and you know, some were down significantly, but you have an explanation of why in the report instead of just leaving us to wonder about, geez, why was outreach down so much? Well, it was because a contract ended in a very successful way. So thank you. It's a great way to format the report and encourage you to keep showing the reasons why things go up or things go down. It helps us a lot. So thank you.
Really noted.
Lee?
I just want to make sure I understood correctly. You mentioned you're in October going to be taking the chair of the SRAI. Is that correct?
The presidency, yes.
Presidency. Okay. Well, congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. I will add that I learned last month that my colleague who oversees sponsored programs at Western Illinois will be taking over as the president of the other largest international research administration organization as their president in 2026. So, I mean, if we step back and think about the fact that two of the presidents in 2026 of the two largest research administration international associations are from Illinois institutions and are from Illinois regional public institutions, that's just remarkable.
Yeah. Is that a one-year term?
I mean, it's a five-year.
Five-year term, wow. So. A lot can happen in 5 years.
Indeed. Indeed.
John?
I want to echo the interest in some guidance on communication, and just note that this has been a project of the board's for quite some time. It really is the root of the creation of this standing committee, is the board wanted to bring up to the board level dialogue about NIU standing as a research institution, a research and artistry institution. And as we think about the language is changing some, right? Because the term an emerging research institution, that term might be have use in some sectors, but may not be the best word to use when we're talking to a state senator. You know, and it might not be the best word or words to use when we're talking to a student and trying to do some of that brand driving that you mentioned to reassure them that they're at a really high quality institution. And on that note too, I think it's never too early to introduce these points of pride and this terminology to the student body, because they, I think, in terms of retention, in terms of pride, and in terms of, you know, just reinforcing the choice to come to NIU, it'd be wonderful if we could get them using these terms, because there's so many other ways in which NIU is described, even, and I'm not talking about the people that are working against us, but, you know, the media might talk about us as a directional university, or just as a regional university, and to get the language of a research institution out would be really helpful. As a sort of, I mean, we're not talking about trying to create something that we're not. We're talking about defining what we are.
Anyone else? I did have one question here. So I do read these reports, and I was, maybe it's a little in the weeds, but we have Navistar funding. It's 6% of instructional program funding. And so is that like a class that we sold from the College of Engineering?
Most likely that's probably reported under the College of Business as one of the MBA
engineering
courses.
Engineering,
yes.
Yeah.
They do some training as well, and it could have been a student-led senior design project.
Okay.
That gets reported in our report.
Okay. All right. That's interesting that we're doing that. So, all right. Thank you. Great presentation, by the way.
Thank you.
So, thank you. So let's move on to agenda item 7D, faculty presentations. So Godwin and Anna.
Hello, everyone. I wanted to show my face today, but current COVID precautions recommend that I continue masking for a few days. So,
thank you.
Of course. I wanted to thank VP Mozarski for inviting me to speak today with you, Chair Vasovich. So, my name is
Hello.
Anna Kliss, and I'm an associate professor in the Department of Economics in the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences. So Godwin Kwabla-Ekpe was my very first PhD student. I'll introduce you to him in another slide. But I'll be presenting the highlights of my work with my former PhD student, and this work was recently commended. So next slide, please. So first, a little on who I am and how I got to NIU. I completed my undergraduate studies at Georgetown University, and I did my PhD at UT Austin. So this was in international economics and then economics with a focus on microeconomic theory and game theory. I came straight here after my PhD, and I've been here ever since. I did show up and was a little bit younger than my very first students. So I managed to get through tenure and promotion during the pandemic, and I wanted to say that I came to NIU specifically because the department really convinced me. They needed someone like me, a theorist who could talk to folks with applied interests. Our PhD program is rather small. We do not train theorists ourselves. But every applied economist still needs a strong background in the theoretical foundations of micro and macro. And so, since I'm a game theorist, I'm really interested in different sorts of situations that can be modeled and therefore I really like the application stories and am happy to talk to students about why theory is important and useful. And so I've mentioned game theory. Game theory is a field of economics where we look at strategic interactions between agents. So a lot of economics is market economics. Imagine yourself going to Schnucks. You're not going to think about how to best haggle over the price of an apple. You're going to take the price of the apple as given. Same with the farmer, honestly. They're going to say this is the market price of the apples right now as well. Meanwhile, in game theory, we do take that negotiation under prerogative. And I examine situations in particular that have spillover effects. So that's externalities in the economic jargon, but essentially where myself taking an action, I'm affecting you, and you have no say about that. But in game theory, maybe we can talk to each other about that. And in particular, I like to focus on environmental public goods. And I focus on agreements that may or may not involve payments. So today, I'll be looking at groundwater as a public good and attempts to reduce overpumping using a fee structure. Next slide, please. So this was my student, Godwin. He graduated in May 2021. He is currently at JP Morgan Chase, and we are extremely proud of him for that. So this paper, Spillover Effects in Aggregated Agriculture from the Groundwater Commons, this was the third chapter of Godwin's dissertation. And after he defended and finished, while I worked with him throughout his PhD, he brought me on as a co-author afterward to sort of beef up the game theoretic section and shepherd the publication it through the publication process. We were successful. We published it last year in Environmental and Resource Economics, which is one of the top field journals. And this summer, we got some really exciting news that it was chosen as a highly committed paper by the European Association of Environmental and Resource Economists. Now, as a highly committed paper, that meant it was one of the top four papers out of the 97 published in their journal last year. So it was something that was a really big deal to both of us. In particular, what they cited was that they appreciated the writing and how it balanced the theory with the empirics, which is exactly my goal. So to talk a little bit about the paper, next slide, please. Our main research question was whether we can observe spillover effects in water use intensity, groundwater pumping, without data on ground transmissivity. So if you can play the animations. So the first animation here, or I guess next slide, please. So data on water transmissivity, that's what's going on with the hydrogeologists, of which we have a few at NIU as well. So water that's underground, it's connected. If you pull it up in one place, that means it might not be available in another place. And so a transmissivity study would be looking at how it flows and where it goes. Well, for various reasons, we might not have that. So next slide. And so in our case, next slide, instead what we have is observational data. We can see how much they pumped. We might not be able to see the water connections exactly, but we can also see how much was planted, what crops were types of planted. And what we're counting on is that neighboring farmers can see that as well. So even if they aren't having access to the exact groundwater transmissivity data or looking at the water levels of their neighbor, they can see whether their neighbor had more, put the center point out longer this year. Next slide, please. Now, our second question was whether these water usage spillovers then translate even in the, over into production spillovers. So if they're changing their water usage, are they also changing their planting behavior? So our research strategy was twofold. We had a game theoretic model that examined water scarcity and crop choice, and then we had an econometric empirical approach that examined exactly these questions. As a preview, we found that there is a spatial relationship, that the water usage of neighbors greatly matters, and that in fact, the indirect effects, the spillover effects, can outweigh direct effects. Next slide, please. So what is a direct effect versus an indirect effect? A direct effect is a response to your own variable. So if I am an irrigator, I look at my well height and I think, okay, what do I need to do? How might I change my own pumping behavior? An indirect effect is a reaction to what are the ones around me doing? So how would I change my pumping in response to my neighbor's depth to water? And so if we were to ignore the game theory of this situation, we might completely miss that indirect effect. And that's something that Godwin and I have argued that the literature in the past has done. Next slide, please. So with regards to why this is important, climate change means that water scarcity issues are getting worse, and the groundwater are a commons. And so the aquifer needs to sort of, because it does not have full property rights established, we need to figure out ways to manage it. Next slide, please. And one of the ways we might ask to do this is whether a water fee can reduce pumping. Now, in the literature, we find that the average response, or this elasticity, responsiveness to a fee, is very small, close to zero. So inputting a fee really doesn't seem to change much of behavior in the literature. Next slide, please. In fact, we find that this responsiveness is affected by a number of things, the hydrogeological environments, the cultural behaviors. Next slide, please. And we've got results ranging from complete and total failure of fee implementation schemes to very small effects to, in some places, significant effects. So this was also a puzzle in the literature that we were trying to unravel. Next slide, please. Water scarcity matters because it is literally baked into the cost of water extraction. So when we have ground level and we have groundwater height, we call that distance depth to water. So the larger this distance is, the more scarce the water is. Literally, the harder it is to pump it out, the more electricity you need to use to get the water out of the ground. So if we think about scarcity as literally an input cost, we can see why scarcity matters even for producers. And so our first innovation in this model was to take a crop choice model and actually add that scarcity in as part of the cost structure. Next slide, please. Now, Richard talked a lot about passion. This is my passion. I sit and write down equations all day, and I love to do it, very truly. I'm great fun at parties, I promise. Our second innovation was to apply a game theoretic lens to this guy. So this is a total profit maximization problem. In there, buried in there, you'll see the Greek letter pi. That is profit. And so this is a crop level profit where essentially the farmer is choosing how much land to allocate to each crop and how much water to allocate to that land then. Next slide, please. So what I do is I compare what an irrigator would do on their own while maximizing this equation to what a coordinated effort between two irrigators would do. So they take their functions and they add them together. Now, in the industrial organization field of economics, that is usually called collusion, but in environmental economics, we think of it as cooperation. And so by looking at the differences between those two problems, we define this externality, the spillover. And I didn't want to put up the gobbledygook that the answer was, but essentially we find that it is likely negative. So this spillover effect is negative. I use more water. I take down your profits. You use more water, you're diminishing my profits. So that's what we see happening there. There is a slight case that the math gobbledygook shows us that it could be positive if the way that farmers responded was to allocate a lot more land to most of their crops. And that's not going to be likely. The only really case I could imagine would be somebody completely switching to very water, non-intensive crops for their entire field. Next slide, please. So with an understanding of the structure from the game theoretic model, we took this to data. Now, our study area was the San Luis Valley in Colorado. The reason for this is they have a really nice data platform available online. Now, this is most of the work that our graduate students are doing. They need data, and so they work with what they can find to essentially ask these interesting questions. Now, so we looked at particularly the years 2005 through 2013. The San Luis Valley is also interesting because they have started implementing pumping fees, and they are a very water-scarce region. Next slide, please. Here's a map of our study area. Now, that kind of reddish-orangish area in the center, that is subdistrict number one. They are the ones that implemented a fee in 2011, so that we can actually see in our study data. The other areas, they have implemented fees since then, so an interesting follow-up would be to update the data and look again. Next slide, please. Now, this is my students and many of my colleagues' passion, this equation. What we mostly do is the econometric approach, which is essentially a lot of questions in economics, you can't run experiments. It's not an experimental science by the large part. And so what we use is large data sources and run very complicated trend lines. That's oversimplifying it quite a bit. But here what we'd be interested in is if on the left-hand side we have something like how much water we're pumping out of the ground, and on the right-hand side we have, well, what's my depth to water? What's my neighbor's depth to water? And what are all the characteristics of my farm and my neighbor's farms, et cetera? And you'll notice on that right-hand side in the equation, we have this capital W. This is a spatial weighting matrix. So this is our third large innovation in this piece. Now, literally, a matrix is a box of numbers. And so here, each row and column correspond to how does this neighbor affect this neighbor. And so if that matrix turns out to be statistically significant in our regression, then we know that spatial dependence really matters. Next slide, please. Now here, I yell at my students always for having tiny numbers on screens, and I did my best not to do the same, but I am sorry. I did want to highlight for you the W in the lower corner, that is positive and statistically significant. So that means that that weighting matrix, what's in it, really matters. These real world spillovers are present in the data. Now, the fee will notice it has a small negative statistically significant direct and indirect effect. So the fee, sure, adding a fee means pumping is decreased, very little. But on the other hand, we see that the depth to water has positive coefficients on both the direct and indirect effect. What does that mean? As depth to water gets bigger, we're getting scarcer, right? So if a larger depth to water means I'm pumping more. Next slide, please. And so we can see that both my depth to water and my neighbor's depth to water, they increase my pumping. Surface water predictably decreases pumping if you have access to that. Next slide, please. Now, the context of that is this is competitive pumping behavior. As the resource is getting more scarce, we are competing harder over it. And so essentially, we're seeing this sort of vicious cycle. Next slide, please. Now, earlier I mentioned the importance of the direct versus indirect effects. The earlier numbers were from a 1 mile radius estimation when we did a 0.5 mile radius estimation, so even closer to the area affected. We found that the indirect effect was 3 times as large as the direct effect. So in this case, it's not even my scarcity that's really determining what I'm doing, but if I'm on the edges of my property, if I'm very close to a lot of neighbors, their pumping is determining what I'm doing. Next slide, please. Now, I also spoke about the production spillovers. So here's what we have that happens with acreage irrigated. Here we see actually that as my depth to water, my scarcity increases, my acreage decreases. So next slide, please. This means that we are planting less. Pumping more, but planting less. So that's sort of an interesting thing that we need to see. It certainly shows that scarcity is therefore going to be then affecting the provision of crops in the long run. Again, that spatial weighting matrix is important. Next slide, please. So what are we learning from this? First of all, that non-spatial models that fail to capture these spillover effects, if they are being used for policymaking, they're going to lead to wrong policy choices. And it also means that irrigators are essentially, just by observing everyday things, they are taking into account what their neighbors are doing. Next slide, please. We also see that even when a pumping fee is imposed, the competitive behavior persists. So the pumping fee might not be the exact right tool the way we know it right now. And this is where that theoretical model comes back in. It actually suggests from the math there that maybe we could consider irrigator-specific or crop-specific fees that could be better targeted to actually impact the behavior. So thank you very much for your time, and I look forward to your questions.
Thank you very much. Any questions at all, or? I'm curious, so you ever work with John List at all at University of Chicago?
No, he's a very big name, but I've never worked with him.
Okay, actually he sends his kids to the baseball camp here at NIU, so he's a big NIU fan.
All right, well maybe I'll have to reach out on LinkedIn.
Yeah, so it just reminds me of reading Voltage and stuff like that. This is awesome stuff for Dick Thaler with Nudge and all that,
yes.
So yeah. Lee?
I really appreciate the content here. Anything agriculture always intrigues me. And I'll speak on just on a personal note water has been a huge issue for agriculture for decades and will continue to be. And we are very fortunate here in the upper Midwest that we are in the Great Lakes Basin. But I'll use an example because the economics of agriculture really drive this water issue as well. And I'll use the example of the dairy industry, a huge user of water. From the 1960s up until recent years, there was a large influx of dairies that went to the West Coast in the state of California. Mm-hmm. California has a very delicate and challenged water situation.
To put it mildly, yes.
And the economics and government and state government regulation in California in the last decade, you've seen a lot of those dairies leave California, and they've located largely a lot of them in Colorado, in the I-76 corridor that runs from Denver up through Fort Morgan, Colorado, because of less regulation.
Birthplace of Glenn Miller, by the way, Fort Morgan.
Yes. And it's driven by the economics and the regulation. But it has placed new pressures on the water situation in that area. We have a company in our investment fund portfolio that's headquartered in Greeley that produces edible beans, which is a good rotational crop in that area because now the dairy situation, you have a lot more intensity in growing corn and alfalfa livestock feeds for the dairy industry. And again, ultimately, it is economics and the government regulation that really drive what's going on in the water sector as well. So I appreciate the analysis. I'd love to spend a little bit more time at a future date reviewing this and learning more, because I am not an expert in water, but it is a huge issue nationally in agriculture.
I'd be more than happy to talk more about this. I can say that Godwin's first essay, which did not involve the game theory, he looked at water stress level, and he found that the most responsive to policy were actually the most water-stressed farmers that were already using the least. Mm-hmm. And so there is a clear mismatch in targeting of policy as well. And so if that's what folks are responding to, then the policy still needs to be written better. And therefore, this is a question just ripe for understanding and picking apart.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
John?
A curiosity question. So, and I'm really a novice in this area. So, I understand that some of the issues in the West with respect to water tables and where there is really concerning scarcity has to do with certain entitlements by treaty or law that relates to what a particular region can pull, and they're pulling it even though they don't need it. Because they have that entitlement and they're worried about losing that opportunity, or just it's because they can. Mm-hmm. And then down the river, so to speak, they really need it and aren't necessarily entitled to it. So where does entitlement come into play?
Sure. So I can speak to that on two different levels. First, I think that our main result is a mini pastiche of that, essentially, where they're pulling out more water despite the scarcity. So that's already that competitive behavior you're mm-hmm. describing there, just on a smaller scale. Pull it out before somebody else can. Now, our study area in particular is interesting because that subdistrict number one is known as the closed basin area. And so the water there, actually, and I learned a lot about hydrogeology for this project. That's part of what I love. It doesn't go anywhere. So the water that flows into that subdistrict in particular stays there. And therefore, it doesn't contribute to the Rio Grande. But then there are entitlements on the entire groundwater conservation district, where the federal government, for instance, has the right to pull out some water out of that closed subbasin and put it into the Rio Grande so that it can flow down to Texas and to Mexico later. Mm-hmm. So that entitlements question, it's baked into this research of understanding what happens if we're passing along the plate at dinner and somebody literally gets to take it first. Mm-hmm. So I hope that answers it a little bit.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate it. It's fascinating research. I'm really, really impressed. And for our new trustee, this might seem a little strange. Why are we doing this? This is one of the joys of being on this board is we periodically learn from faculty about their research. And we've learned about a whole spectrum of types of activity and, in some cases, artistry. So.
Yeah, if I could kind of add to that, Professor Kliss, I don't know if you remember me, but
I took
an intro to environmental econ my first semester here at Northern with Professor Kliss. So I just want to say thank you for this research, and I just want to let everyone in the audience and on the board know that she leads with compassion with her students as well. Mm-hmm. Kind of coming to NIU, she was great, kind of first one of my first professors to have. So she's wonderful to work with. So thank you.
That was a tough COVID semester where we were all in masks all the time. So it was really cool to see you today.
Anyone else? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Might also add that John List is the one that instituted tipping on Uber. So through his studies, that like you've laid out here as well, so you can thank John for that. Other matters, are there any other matters requiring the attention of the board today? Hearing none, the next meeting of the Research and Innovation Legal and Legislative Affairs Committee is on November the 7th. Ooh, that should be a pretty good day, 2024. And may I have a motion to adjourn the meeting?
So moved, Gail.
Second, Herrera.
We have a motion and we have a second. Mrs. Wright, will you please call the question?
Yes. Committee Vice Chair Rita Athes?
Yes.
Trustee Dennis Barsima?
Yes.
Trustee John Butler?
Yes.
Trustee Veronica Herrero?
Yes.
Trustee Aiden O'Brien?
Yes.
Trustee Leland Strum?
Yes.
Committee Chair Eric Wasowitz?
Yes.
Board Chair Montel Gales?
Yes.
Thank you.
This meeting is now adjourned. This concludes the Research and Innovation Legal and Legislative Affairs Committee meeting.